Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Terry Tempest Williams. Terry Tempest Williams grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah. Her most recent book, entitled Red, Patience and Passion in the Desert, speaks of her love and commitment to the desert and to the preservation of the Red Rock Wilderness of southern Utah. Her recent book, entitled Leap, is a wild journey into the world of Hieronymus Bosch's masterpiece, The Garden of Delights. Her book, Refuge in a Natural History of Family and Place, is considered a classic in American nature writing. Other books include a collection of essays, An Unspoken Hunger, Desert Quartet, An Erotic Landscape, Coyote's Canyon, and Pieces of White Shell, A Journey to Navajo Land. She is also the author of two children's books, The Secret Language of Snow and Between Cattails. Williams has served on the governing council of the Wilderness Society and was a member of the Western team for the President's Council for Sustainable Development. She is currently on the advisory board of the National Parks and Conservation Association, the Nature Conservancy, and the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. She was recently inducted to the Rachel Carson Honor Roll and has received the National Wildlife Federation's Conservation Award for Special Achievement. In 1991, Newsweek identified Williams as someone likely to make a considerable impact on the political, economic, and environmental issues facing the Western states this decade. The Utney Reader named her as one of their Utney 100 visionaries, in their words, a person who could change your life. She has been a fellow for the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation and received a Lannan Literary Fellowship in Creative Nonfiction. And I had to actually cut out a lot there.
You can cut out more. You know, just.
But welcome.
Thank you so much, Jan. Yeah. I'm thrilled to be back in Pittsburgh, and it's wonderful to meet you. I love your work.
Oh, thank you. So we're going to start. We're going to focus on your book called Leap because it's amazing. And you're going to begin with a short piece from a section called Paradise.
Yes, and I'll place this in context quickly. I come from a Mormon family. Extended family is important. And in many ways, my grandmother raised us. And we would go over and spend the night and stay there. And we slept in what we called her turquoise room, which was turquoise. And there was a huge bulletin board above the bed where we slept. And for years, there were these two panels, Paradise and Hell, painted by Hieronymus Bosch. I can tell you it was quite unsettling, to say the least. Bosch's Hell is truly hell. Grotesque images, an egg man broken open, fire, flames, etc. And heaven is very benign, pink, calm, serene. Years later, I think I was in my late 30s, my husband Brooke and I went to Madrid. We had frequent flyer miles. We went to the great art museum, the Prado. We were wandering through the galleries looking at Velázquez, Goya, El Greco, turned the corner into Gallery 57A, and there was this magnificent medieval triptych called The Garden of Earthly Delights. I nearly fell to my knees, Jan, because there were the two panels that I had been raised under, Heaven and Hell. But what stood in the center was the Garden of Earthly Delights, the body of the triptych, my body. I never knew that center panel existed. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly, it was, why was this withheld from me, the body of the triptych? And what began as just a simple vacation to Spain turned into a 7-year meditation. Mm-hmm. And what I'm going to read to you from the section called Paradise was part of that contemplation. Again, just a brief footnote. I had been out birdwatching in Retiro Park behind the Prado. It was very hot, as it gets in Spain. The light's very intense. I decided this is a perfect time to go back into the Prado and watch the painting. I had binoculars around my neck. I sat down at the chair to watch the painting, as I always do. And without thinking, I began birdwatching the triptych. I take down my binoculars and let them dangle around my neck. The guards are staring. I open my notebook and make a checklist of all the bird seen so far in El Jardín de las Delicias. Swifts, scarlet ibis, great white egret, little egret, wagtail, blue rock thrush, cuckoo, spoonbill, white pelican, night heron, blue heron, stork, white ibis, jackdaw, stonechat, red start, rook, brambling, pheasant, jay, mallard, gadwall, hoopoe, green woodpecker, kingfisher, robin, magpie, goldfinch, great tit, long-eared owl, teng mom's owl, tawny owl, pygmy owl, little owl, widgeon. I look up. The guard nods. The Prado is closing. Who knows how much time has passed in the country of Bosch? I tuck my binoculars into my bag with my notebook and leave.
Okay. This book has been called by some a departure from nature writing, but I really don't see it that way. And I was wondering what you thought about it. To me, it looks like a deeper sort of interrogation into spirit, into other worlds, and as organically related to the natural world. So I don't sort of understand that some people see it as such a departure. I mean, I know it's a total obsession with this Hieronymus Bosch triptych, but it seems that you connect everything so well in the book.
You know, I think one of the problems with defining genres is it limits the perception. And I honestly don't know what nature writing is. As a writer, and I'm sure you feel this as a poet, all we can do is really follow our passions, follow our obsessions, and live with the questions that seize us. For me, in many ways, this was a sequel to Refuge. If Refuge began with the question, how do we find refuge in change? A rising Great Salt Lake, my mother's diagnosis with cancer, and ultimately the process of living in the process of dying. Leap really circles around the question, what do we believe? To whom do we pray? And for me, the landscape of Hieronymus Bosch, this medieval triptych, was similar to the landscape of Great Salt Lake. And I think you're right. It is an extension of perception. It's an extension of the inquiry into the spiritual landscape. And in that way, if refuge is an exploration of an external landscape, this is the internal landscape.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in the form of the book. I mean, you have the four sections, you know, paradise, hell, earthly delights, and restoration. But beyond that, your sentences, you know, you vary your sentence length using, you often use the power of short statements. You give us intense, extended description and then follow it with an open-ended question. And then you have lists, you lead us, you weave, and then you jolt us a lot of times. And it seems to me that you are sort of enacting this leaping all the way through the book in form.
In many ways, leap is an improvisation of language. And I was very interested in the French writer Helena Cixous, when she asks us to speak the language women speak when there is no one there to correct us. You know, as women, we are given a linear form. We are given a particular grammar and syntax. And I find that very limiting. And Cixous asked the question, what might it be to write out of the body? And I took her literally. And I wanted to see what that would be like to write out of the body so that the structure was an organic structure, not a linear structure. Mm-hmm. There are times when I will be the first to admit I leap right off the page. Mm-hmm. But I think it's these leaps of language. It's the attempt to push and stretch the boundaries of language as far as they can go. And I loved seeing the shape of the mind on the page. You know, my mind is not fluid. I leap all over the place. And yeah. I wanted to see what that looked like on the page. I remember giving this manuscript to my father, who's, you know, a Reaganite, very conservative, and we talk almost every day. I didn't hear from him for 3 weeks, and I thought, I'm not going to call him. You know, I'm going to let him call me. You know how we get into that mm-hmm. drama. Finally, I couldn't stand it. I called him. I said, Dad, you've had this manuscript 3 weeks. What do you think? And he said, I'm stuck in hell, and I don't want to talk about it. You know, he hated the book. It's not a book that makes one comfortable.
Right.
But then Hieronymus Bosch is not a painter that makes one comfortable. And I felt because of his leaps of faith on the painting, on the canvas, I could do the same on the page. And I love his hybrids. these bizarre creatures, half human, half wild. I loved that there are a million tableaus spilled on the painting in this triptych, and that I could do the same, that there could be fractures and fragments, and that you could open this book in any place and find a starting point.
Yeah, it's really exhilarating in that way, just to pick it up. If you're just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Terry Tempest Williams, reading from her book Leap. You have a section from, you have a reading from the Hell section.
That was the section I spent the most time in. And not an easy time, I have to say. Hell. Open and close. Open and close. The wings of El Bosco's butterfly are fanning the fires of hell. The flames blur, obscure the view of paradise. Now I see El Bosco's masterpiece as a map of the human mind. On the left, the mind of the child, pure and innocent. We believe what we are told. We stay in paradise as long as possible. On the right, the mind of the mad, dark and duplicitous. We are all manic depressives, with mood swings bashing against brass, like the tongues of bells that erode our sense of equilibrium. Left hollow, our bodies are taken over by demons. My mind, out of my mind, I have abandoned paradise. In hell, my eyes dilate. Even the hollow man's eyes are black. Inside, a woman fills a jug with wine as three individuals naked are sitting on the backs of toads around a red table playing cards. I see their cards. They flash them toward me like a mirror. In the mirror, I see a woman's back. She is looking out of the eggshell cavern, her hand barely holding up her head. The world is on fire. What are we to do? Hope flickers the flame inside this cave, this cavern of light and dark. Can you see? I have seen the bulls who dance on the walls of Altamira. Light and dark, they return to me here in the cavern tavern. The bulls are standing upright. Their cloven hooves paw my mind, sear my mind. Their muscles are made of stone. My brothers and sisters, can you see these drawings too? Painted on the white walls of skulls here in El Bosco's hell, images that flicker and flicker and flare, then fade. What are we to do? In times of trouble, I call on the painters, ancient and new, to draw our world together. It is the night jar, the night ajar, the open door of doubt that allows demons to devour my mind, my conscious, unconscious mind, this delectable mind. If I cannot bend the higher powers, I will stir up the lower depths. Look. Look away. There is such a thing as evil. I hide behind another human being. I can find no friends in hell. I watch a game of solitaire where the last remaining cards are a two of hearts and a three of clubs. Let the cards fall as they may, they say. Must we? Must we witness and watch and do nothing as road cuts, clear cuts, the cut bodies of coyote, mountain lion, and deer are strung up on their hind legs as a warning to others that they are not welcome? Must we witness and watch and do nothing as the peeled bodies of elders named Douglas fir, cedar, and larch are chained to the flatbeds of trucks and hauled away on our highways, highways littered with roadkills, roadkills paving the way to dams, dammed rivers, the Colorado, the Columbia, the Snake, and Mississippi, dammed canyons, Glen Canyon, Davis Gulch, Cathedral in the desert, speak their names, remember their names, these places of beauty, these places of origin, toxic waste, toxic deserts, bombed, battered, and betrayed. In the name of national security, speak their names. Remember their names. The Nevada test site in the Mojave, Hanford on the banks of the Columbia, Rocky Flats, Alamogordo, Dugway, the floodplains of eastern Idaho. The nuclear waste is simmering, shimmering. Coyote watches with burning eyes, Bosch's owl with burning eyes in paradise. There is a war raging within our own nation, and it is not civil. Speak their names, remember their names. They are going, going, the salmon, grizzly, tortoise, tiger beetle, bobcat and lynx, marbled murrelet, red-spotted frog. They are disappearing before our eyes, our own eyes. Find their eyes, burning eyes. We are slowly committing suicide. This is the natural history of the dead.
I'm wondering, and I wondered many times reading the hell section, how you continued, you know, to look. I mean, I'm sure you said it was a 7-year meditation to going back and back to this painting. But I feel like I have a great capacity for darkness, but there are a lot of times I had to stop reading and look away, and then I returned. But what was that like for you, writing the hell section?
It was really, really hard. And I committed to looking as far as I could. And there was a point where I had to stop, because I knew if I had gone any further, I wouldn't be able to come back. But I also knew that in the point, and again, I just kept coming back to the triptych, to the painting, Hieronymus Bosch, his vision. And keep in mind, this is in the 16th century, 1500. The brightest point in the triptych, the point of greatest illumination, occurs in hell.
Mm-hmm.
When there is this bright window of yellow light. And to me, that was the clue, to be able to shoot through the darkness into that light, that our only way through hell is the direct passage. And through that, you come into that place of hope, the Garden of Earthly Delights, restoration.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be true.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and I really loved it when you talked about the path of amnesia being created in the modern world. And these are your words. You said, without memory, there is no emotion. Without emotion, there is no experience. Without experience, there is only abstraction. And I love how this takes us back to story as a vehicle for everything. And that comes up again and again in your book. And remembering story, valuing experience. And yet, in the writing world today, in the publishing world, I mean, there's a lot of forces at work against story, I think.
I think story is critical. As writers, we are storytellers, and there's always been storytellers as long as there's been human beings. And again, that spark of flame, stories told around the fire that remind us what it means to be human, what we're connected to. I think storytelling is the umbilical cord that connects us to the past, present, and future. It keeps things known. When someone tells a story, it's as though a third person enters the room, and we become accountable for that knowledge which has been shared.
Mm-hmm.
Story becomes the conscience of the community. And I think most importantly, storytelling bypasses rhetoric and pierces the heart. And what we have is a direct experience. And to me, that's what we are hungry for in this modern world, is direct experience, feeling, not simply opinion.
Thank you. I agree. Okay, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. My guest tonight is the writer Terry Tempest Williams, reading from her book entitled Leap. You have a section entitled Earthly Delights that you...
That's the middle panel. That's the body. That's the joy. That's, again, I hate to keep going back to my father, but he just said, I can't believe you spent 7 years looking at this center panel with naked bodies running all over. You know, well, that's one way of looking at it. But to me, it is the central response to the land. It's blackberries, strawberries, blueberries, you know, just this wonderful fecund world. Intense, direct joy.
Mm-hmm.
Literally in the center of heaven and hell. You know, I think so often, and especially when you look at where we are now, and forgive me, Jan, but, you know, I feel like we're in the middle of, that we are now citizens of a fundamental government where we have a president who says, you're either with us or you're against us. The world is painted in black and white. Again, those two panels, heaven and hell. I think what Bosch shows us is there is this middle way. There is the radical center, earth, the ground underneath our feet, and we begin there.
Okay. Can you read a short piece from there?
Certainly. My left hand reaches to touch. What can I feel but a blue blackberry, earthly blue? They say my pulse is returning. I am returning to the place I feared was gone. I can touch and taste my own irrepressible hunger, rise to eat this lip-luscious fruit, the flesh of these berries, blackberries, raspberries, blueberries, and strawberries. This triptych was once called the strawberry in medieval days. Ripe on the vine, heavy on the bough, I pick each one a delicacy in hand, a red-violet-blue weight on my tongue. On this day I taste the joy, explode with joy, smear the joy all over my face. Feed me cherries and I will feed you grapes, deep red purple grapes, one grape at a time. Time, the most luxurious gift in this garden is time. Time to talk, time to eat, time to love, time to drink, discover, uncover, expose, explore, ponder, dream, create. Time to do nothing but sit and stare, look and listen and wonder how it is, why it is that we have strayed so far from this world of naked truth. What the heart desires can be dreamed.
The final section of the book is called Restoration, and did you know when you were writing the book that you would arrive at restoration?
No idea.
Okay.
And again, that's what I love about writing. To me, one of the reasons we write a book is to embark on this unknown journey. And all I knew is that I was obsessed with the painting. I had no idea where it would lead me. If I had, I'm not sure I would have stayed there. But I was possessed. And I remember one day walking into the Prado and the painting was gone. Poof, vanished. What I learned is that it was in the process of restoration. What I didn't know that ultimately to me was the key of where I was going, also into that process of restoration after the death of my mother and my own spiritual restoration.
I'd like you to read that section because I want to make sure that we get that on the air.
So. And I would just say as a footnote, there were two wonderful women, the de Avila sisters, who are premier art conservators, restorers of paintings in the Prado, and they have been schooled by the old masters. It's a word of mouth tradition that stretches back thousands of years. And Jan, I had that experience. They invited me to take a white cloth, douse it, drench it in what they call artist spirit, and I was able to wipe away the 500-year grime of the painting and see this center panel washed anew.
I'd be afraid to touch it.
It was incredible. It was just incredible. The restoration of nature, even our own, will require a reversal of our senses and sensibilities, to see with our heart, to touch with our mind, to smell with our hands, to taste with our eyes, to hear with the soles of our feet.
Okay. It's clearly a hopeful message there, but much more than that. And this idea of individual agency is returned to over and over again in the book. And after completing the book, how do you feel that it changed you, this whole...
I grew up, as I said, in an Orthodox Mormon family. I think Hieronymus Bosch moved me from the landscape of Orthodoxy into a landscape of spirituality. And I think he also, his influence allowed me to physically move from Salt Lake City to the desert. And so for me, this was a contemplation that led to a spiritual liberation. Maybe that's the process we go through in the middle of our lives. But he gave me a visual vocabulary that helped me to define my own.
That's pretty big.
It was. It was huge, and I was haunted by him. Brooke and I, my husband, we used to laugh saying that when we would sit down to eat dinner, we would have three place settings, one for Brooke, one for myself, and one for El Bosco.
Yeah. One of the things I loved in the book was this idea of the luxurious watching and a sense of time leaving and then returning in a fullness. How has time changed in your life since this writing? I mean, do you take more of it for yourself, or does it have a different feeling for you?
It was a meditation, and I think meditation does change the shape of one's mind. After watching this painting so intensely, I was eager to go back into the physical world. And I think part of my meditation practice, I'm certainly not a Buddhist, it is nothing again orthodox, but I would say my daily practice is walking in the desert. And it is the difference. It's that practice of seeing, not simply looking, that practice of listening, not simply hearing, but really, again, that direct experience. I think the first part of my life, I'm 47 now, when I was working as a naturalist in the Museum of Natural History, it was learning about nature everything I could get my hands on, books, to learn the names of things. I think now in the second part of my life, I'm interested in learning from nature,
mm-hmm.
which I think is an immersion of the senses.
Mm-hmm. And yet to even attempt this project of watching and watching the painting and seeing, you had to almost be there already, right? I mean, you had to be someone who was willing to go back and go back to the painting.
I'm not sure. I think I was so hungry for what he had to give that it was really the act of hunger that drew me mm-hmm. there. And again, the obsession, it was not a comfortable place to be. And I wouldn't go back to that place. but it was about love. And I think, again, we follow our passions and obsessions, mm-hmm. and they lead us to our own naked truth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have just a few minutes left. I guess I'll just say a couple of things that I thought the book was about in addition to what you've been saying. And it seems like a book that you have to read over and over to me, or pick up and start in the middle again and revisit. But I was, you know, so impressed with the fever, the sense of fever in the book, and intellect sort of firing together. I mean, it just seemed like everything, all cylinders were working, seemed to me.
Some would call that madness.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I did have a fever. I mean, Hieronymus Bosch is a hallucination. Mm-hmm. And I remember a lot of my friends who are a bit older than me, they said, Terry, you know, this was the poster that was hanging in our dorm rooms during the 60s. Where were you? You know, we were all smoking dope looking at this thing. And I was saying, you know, I said, I was in Salt Lake City. You know, and so maybe I came to this late, but Hieronymus Bosch, I think, was a visionary. And I think it's important to realize he was painting this on the cusp of the Reformation. And I believe 500 years later, this time does not separate us. And I think in a way we are on the threshold of another Reformation, call it an ecological Reformation. And I think that's where we look to the past and it speaks directly to the future.
Okay. We're out of time. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, Jan, thank you. And thank you for daring to take the leap.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joel Grimes and John Belch. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody. Radio made possible with member support, 91.3 WYEP.